again, welcome to Music Ally Focus with me, Music Ally's editor Joe Sparrow, and in this episode, we are joined by Shane Shapiro, PhD, a music and cultural policy thinker whose work focuses on the concept of music cities. We ask him what music cities are, how music intersects with a city's cultural and political policy, and of course, the people in it. And we talk about his upcoming book, which is also on this concept. Now, each Music Ally Focus episode analyzes on one meaningful music business angle at a time. And so this podcast is going to be quick. It should take about the same amount of time as Kent Seipert could hypothetically flip a hammer 3,000 times. Kent flipped a £5 hammer a remarkable, by the way, 101 times in 1 minute in 2021. Kent says, "My whole life, every time I pick up an item, I try to see if I can flip it. As long as I can remember, I've been flipping things," which is a reminder for all of us to follow our dreams. Now, talking of juggling something heavy, Shane Shapiro's upcoming new book, This Must Be the Place, introduces and examines music's relationships to cities. That's not the influence cities have on music, but the powerful impact that music can have on how cities are developed, built, managed, and governed. This is a fascinating concept. It's about the way that music can be used to shape culture around us and the relationship with the people in the places that we live in. So let's go and have a chat to Shane about this right now. So I am very happy to welcome to the podcast Shane Shapiro. Hi, Shane.
Hey, Joe. How's it going?
All the better to see you. Now, can you just kick us off with some basics for context, who you are, what you do, and tell us about the book that you're about to publish and what it all means?
Yeah, so my name is Shane. I live in London. I am the founder of a company called Sound Diplomacy. So Sound Diplomacy has been around for 10 years, working with cities, governments, and large organizations on music policy and strategy. So, you know, we're an economic consulting company, and we really try to focus on explaining the value of music, culture, nighttime economy, and then producing policy, strategy, and evidence so that cities, governments, and whomever can invest in music. And a couple of years ago, I founded a nonprofit called the Center for Music Ecosystems. And the Center for Music Ecosystems is a research organization that really helps create research so music can be used to solve problems in communities. So what I mean by that is really looking at some of the bigger challenges that the UN is tackling, for example, eradicating poverty, sustainable development, gender equality, and how music can be a tool within a larger stream of policy to meet those goals, because music tends to be slightly aside from that. And I wanted to be more of an active participant in that level of research and that level of policymaking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I'm sure that some listeners are
thinking, what is this?
Hearing this.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, bluntly, yes, because you know, music and cities, there's an obvious dynamic there, and we'll discuss that in a minute. But when you let's just touch on that sort of premise about, you know, music being an active tool in changing some of the most important things in society, I'm sure some people could be forgiven for saying, well, how do you do that?
Yeah, of course. So let's break it down into its basic component parts, right? So everything that happens in the places that we live was decided by somebody, right? Every road is designed by somebody. Every building is designed in some way by somebody and went through a process to get to where it is. Even informal settlements are formal because they're settlements, right? And music in place tends to be a recipient of decisions that are made by other people, i.e., you know, the venue is located in a particular part of town, but the buildings that are built around the venue usually have nothing to do with the venue itself. That's why you end up with noise complaints, just as an example. I want to flip it on its head. So my work is, how can we, from the earliest possible stage of when those decisions get made, whatever those decisions are, how can we incorporate in the needs of the music industry and the needs of what I call the music ecosystem? So it's the industry plus education plus health and well-being and other things. Because think about it, if a city is spending more money on its music education policy and educating more kids, right, and providing more instruments and so on and so forth, we are essentially outsourcing our talent development. And if we outsource our talent development, then we're saving money and we're getting better talent in an earlier stage to then invest in and make more out of. So how can we create that foundation? And you can do that in a deliberate and intentional way by understanding how music fits into these other policy areas, whether it is planning and licensing, or whether it is how to look at, you know, really, really complicated things like development financing, like how rich countries invest in poorer countries. Another example of that, and I'll get to my book, is, you know, most of the schools that are built in developing countries are one room, right? If you build a one room school, then you're automatically cutting out music and art because there's literally no place to do it. And there are contracts that are signed by the donor and the recipient that state how big a school should be and what it should have. And music and culture is not included in those contracts. So we are not literally being embedded into the frameworks that are essentially deciding how and why things are the way they are. We are just accepting it. And I think that we could be better than that. I think that the music industry and music is one of the most powerful, catalysts for social change that we have. And also, here's a business that's growing faster than most other businesses that the general public have no idea how it works, right? Literally how it works, how music functions, how it gets from point A to point B, how copyright works. So by demystifying that, by providing these pathways, by acting as a translator, we essentially position ourselves better. We can get more out of it.
It is complicated, isn't it? Because we do think of music as this thing that we just enjoy, everyone enjoys, right? It's a thing, it's ephemeral. There is a business built around it, as all the listeners know, but it's to extend the influence of it to something bigger than artistry is a bit of a leap, I think, for all of us.
Yeah, we do it all the time, right? So, like, we, you know, how many benefit concerts have the listeners been a part of, staged, and so on? How many times have we used music as a tool to raise awareness or to raise money for something else? Yet, when you stage a benefit concert for a country that lacks a copyright framework, how are you going to create jobs in that country through music if there is no respect or understanding of copyright? So we need to start to think about the component parts of society that need to exist for our business to thrive. And maybe in the UK we have them, but in a lot of other, and I know that's up for debate, but in a lot of other countries that is non-existent. And I think that we, by demystifying how music works and then by inserting it into other policy areas, we can gain power, influence, resources, talent, and I believe it will improve all our bottom lines in the process.
All good stuff. Well, let's talk then specifically about the book and Music Cities. First of all, let's just get some clarification there. When you talk about, quote, music's relationship to cities, but not the influence a city has on music, what does that mean exactly?
So I guess my book is called This Must Be the Place, How Music Can Make Your City Better. It's being published in the UK by Repeater Books and distributed by Random House everywhere else. And what I mean by that is it's pretty self-explanatory that a city's story can be told through its music, right? Beatles in Liverpool or Britpop in Manchester or whatever, right? That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the planning, the governance, and the policy of how a city literally works and functions. Through the decisions that are made as to what goes where and why, as to what we spend money on and what we don't spend money on, as to who gets what and why, that is what the book is about, is how music influences the process of creating a city, not so much on the bands that came from a city and the tourism or the branding side of it. I think there's plenty of books about that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that then. What is the impact that music can have on the way that cities, you know, grow, develop, and are governed? You know, can you give some examples around that?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, every city is competing against every other city for the same things, for the most part, right? For talent and for resources. So we're either trying to attract talent or retain talent, keep people here or find new people to come. often the ways that cities do that is by promoting a particular quality of life. And that quality of life is usually down to leisure, what happens after work. And there are different component parts that cities take to promote that. Nature being one, right? Access to nature or a great food scene. A lot of cities tout their music, nighttime economy, cultural scenes as well. But if a city is touting its music and cultural scene, but venues are closing down because of noise complaints, for example, then this is a city that is not building in, as we say, building in music policy rather than bolting it on and really thinking about the structures that are required to sustain what we call vibrant cities. The word vibrancy kind of sometimes bothers me, but or what we call, creative and cultural cities. That's one example. One example is in the planning system, right? And a few listeners may have seen a few other things I've done in the past. I've been working with the Music Venue Trust over many years in the past, and the Mayor of London and others to work on the agent of change provision in the planning framework. And that just means that, you know, the any building that's built next to an existing music venue, for example, has to be soundproofed. And that is the same as if you build a home next to a pig farm, you can't complain about the smell, because pigs smell, music makes noise. And it's this concept that we can have a voice, we can have agency in this process. And in order to have agency in this process and benefit from it in a purely beneficial way, we need to understand how the process works, right? Understand how planning works, how licensing works, what cities spend money on to promote themselves, what cities spend money on to educate residents, to tackle poverty, so on and so forth, right? And when you think about the role that music plays in all of those things, there's always a role for it. It may not be the most important thing, but it's part of the Rolodex, so to speak, or the suite of products. So a lot of communities don't think intentionally about this. It just kind of happens. So a lot of communities will invest in just one festival as their major investment in music. Investing in festivals is great, but investing in one is not equitable. Or build a very large concert hall for hundreds of millions of dollars or euros or pounds, but not have a music education provision in public schools, right? So it's thinking of it a little bit more differently. And that's where the ecosystem idea comes along, where if one part of it is frayed, then that it impacts everything else, like an ecosystem, right?
So it is a holistic view of saying,
yeah,
you know, music. I think that was interesting what you said there about it being, it's not something you bolt on, it's something that you bake in. You know, if you want to be seen as a vibrant city, and most cities, I guess, do want to be seen as somewhere cool and exciting, music is a part of that, then they have to think in that holistic sense about how all the things that fit around music. And again, that sort of goes back to that idea that I think perhaps we sort of instinctively have, isn't it? That music is ephemeral and it's this kind of fun thing, but actually it's very closely baked into our society.
Well, most definitely. And also, you know, music being kind of something that is anti-government historically in some regards, right? So, you know, and this is actually not political. I'm not trying to be political. I'm trying to be pragmatic, right? And, you know, think, you know, if we think differently, right, we have to think about what do we need as a sector to grow, right? And I believe one of the most important things that we need as a sector, as a music industry, commercial music industry to grow, is a greater understanding of the value of music, right? I think that there is a general understanding of the social value of music. That's why A Call to Prayer is musical. That's why I'm sure that no listener has ever been to a wedding or a funeral where there isn't music, right? Yeah. Music exists, but the value of it, to pay for it, to me, spending most of my life talking to people who don't understand the music industry, there's a fundamental lack of understanding of how things work and what are we literally paying for, right? And what is copyright, and how does that work? And the reason I'm saying that's important is because so many places give large tax incentives and other funding to what's called workforce development, right, or economic development, to build stuff. And it's so antiquated that most communities won't support anything that doesn't involve a shovel, right? We always joke, workforce development has to involve a shovel. And what we're seeing is a lack of understanding of how intellectual property works, and that intellectual property is property, and that it can be, you know, disseminated in a myriad ways and have income streams in myriad ways, as we all know. It just is so lost on the people who are making decisions about how our tax money is being used in the places that we live. And then you bolt on Web3 and just gone, right? No one. Yeah. So yeah. It's that job of a translator. And I'm not asking for everyone in the industry to become a translator. I'm just asking, you know, my belief is the more that we're self-aware of our potential power and importance as a sector in influencing the outside world, the more that we can influence the outside world. And that basic fundamental understanding, for example, of copyright is a big challenge. Most people genuinely don't get it. And, you know, especially a lot of people who whose jobs are to make decisions about what to invest in for the future.
My next question was going to be, can cities not be music cities? I mean, it's clear that all cities have music in them, right? Music exists everywhere. But if it's about sort of intentionality, does that mean that some cities are not really music cities?
Yeah, of course. So, like, you know, I'm not branding, I guess I'm speaking hypocritically here as one of the people who, I guess, promulgated the music cities concept. It wasn't ever.
Go ahead. You've got the floor.
It wasn't my intention to create a "We Are a Music City" kind of brand, and a lot of places have done that. I'm sure some people are aware of networks of music cities, like the UNESCO City of Music Network. What we have tried to do is make it a bit more nuanced than that. And a city that is deliberate and intentional about incorporating music into its strategic planning, right? That is a music city. So lots of cities have music. Every city has music. Every city has festivals. Every city, in one way or another, is investing in its musicians, even at a basic level. Even providing singing classes in nursery is investing in the music ecosystem. But yes, I would say the vast, vast majority of cities in the world are not cities that are taking a deliberate and intentional approach to growing their music ecosystem. If we did, we'd have mandatory music programs in senior care facilities, for example, which would pay artists to do that. Or we would have, healthcare systems properly licensing music, or just examples like that, or mandatory music education up into a certain point, or the agent of change provision, and so on and so forth. So lots and lots of cities are doing great work, but it's still like a drop in the ocean. There's over 4,000 cities in the world, over 100,000 people, and there are maybe 300 or 400 that take this seriously.
Right. Well, so that's the sort of overview of the concept and what it means in that sort of extrapolated sense. But let's, you know, from our listeners' perspective, who are working in the music industry, what does it mean for them? What relevance does this have to them in perhaps like a sort of direct business sense?
Well, I think it's all about money, first off, right? Everything is about access, you know, and my question.
You've got everyone's attention now. That's good.
Well, it's not a direct, it's not a direct sale, right? There's my challenge, is I'm not saying that track is going to be used more in a particular situation. But the more that music is invested in your community, the more it's saving you money and creating opportunities to make more money. Because venues are more supported. If there's a strong education system, it's creating a larger groundswell of talent to choose from. There will be more opportunities to perform live, especially at a time when, you know, touring is not only expensive or difficult because of Brexit, and becoming challenging from a carbon perspective. So one of the solutions to that is more opportunities locally for everybody. So the more that cities care about music, the more opportunities to leverage that care. The second side of it is purely investment, is that there are there are tons and tons of programs. In London, there are programs. In Manchester, all over the UK, there are investment programs, whether they're tax incentives or other forms of funding that music companies tend not to qualify for just because they're music companies. And the reason is because music is not seen as a priority economic sector. So making it a priority economic sector creates opportunities to allocate these types of funding. And that is a lobbying effort, obviously, that the trade associations are all doing. Tax incentives have been lobbied in the UK for a long time, and they may or may not happen, but that is in everyone's best interest, right? So being aware of these situations is an opportunity for everybody. So, you know, those are two points right there. I hope demonstrate why this is worth paying attention to and just worth understanding that there is a behind the scenes effort that is working to explain, translate the value of, and create solutions that then cities, communities, tourism boards, economic development corporations, and so on can then adopt to better support music and musicians. And
so,
how was that?
Well, I was going to say, that's pretty good. I mean, I was going to say, like, if someone is listening and they think, okay, I'm in a music city. I know that this city I'm in is carefully investing in infrastructure and thinking and legislation and all these things around music. What is a good way of them to get involved in a way that perhaps is both good for the city, is in a thoughtful way, but is also good, you know, to be frank, for their sort of bottom line?
Well, I think time is our most limited resource, right? So if you're in a city that has a music committee, board, commission, they're called many different things. These do exist in Liverpool, Cardiff, Manchester, Belfast is creating one. Sheffield has one. Just being aware of it. And if it's something that you're interested in, throwing your hat in the ring to be involved, usually a quarterly meetings kind of thing, getting to know people. And that usually gives you a good overview of what's going on in the community. That's a simple way to get involved. It's a little bit more complicated if you're in a place that doesn't have this, because then it has to be set up, right? There are some people who are more politically inclined to know their ward councillors and know their local government officials. It's always, I always say it's a benefit to know who they are, because in a situation where you need to know who they are, it's good that they know who you are. And that they know that you run a business, and that you run a business that is employing people, that is creating revenue, that is creating wealth, because they'll also think of you that way. Those are two different ways, certainly in the UK. I think that there is a certain amount, I have to stress this, there's a certain amount of putting self-interest to one side a little bit for collective self-interest here. A thriving music community may not benefit everyone the same way, right? But I'm an eternal pragmatist. I think doing the right thing and supporting the most amount of people possible benefits everybody. And sometimes, sometimes it's not I'm going to make more money by doing this specific thing, but I'm going to create a better environment that will help everybody, including myself, make more money.
Right. If someone is thinking, well, I get the feeling that my city has a great music scene, people love what's going on, but I don't think that the local authorities are necessarily investing in the right way or keeping it in the right context. Maybe there's, the noise complaints are not going the way of the venues and things like that. How can someone begin to initiate that kind of change of getting people together and saying, right, hey, let's make this a music city step by step.
Well, I guess the first thing is my book will provide
buy
that.
The book, yeah, right? Yeah, that's a good start.
There's one of the chapters is like a blueprint that I've laid out of how to do that, or at least my experiences are doing that. There is no catch-all. There's no this is how you do it specifically. Everything is based on relationships, like in the business, right? Like if you want to create change in your community, then you have to know who to talk to and how to talk to them. The most important thing that I've learned is really understand what's in it for the person that you're talking to. And I think it's probably the same, you know, mind methodology of trying to sell something to someone. It's if you want to improve the music ecosystem in your city, then, you know, you need to identify the local counselor who loves music first off and is willing to listen. And usually people make their love of music clear on social media. And it's reasonably easy to track those people down. And then also understanding what the wider strategic objectives of your city are. All cities write plans that very few people in the music industry read. There's most cities have these 2035 or 2050 plans that are quite general about economic development and creating green jobs and things like that. But they all set targets, right? And all of those targets can be met by investing in the creative economy in one way or another. Because the creative economy is by nature non-extractive, right? We don't need to dig up more oil to invest to write more music IP, right? We already have studios. We already have human beings who can make music. We enough guitars exist. So in essence, it isn't extractive versus other businesses that require the digging up of raw materials and processing of those raw materials to make stuff. So, you know, I think that's probably a complicated answer, but really it's this question of, you know, do you want to be involved in your local community or not? If the answer is I want to have a stake in the future of my local community and I work in this business, then just tell people that you work in the business all the time. Explain to people that this is a job that employs people, that this is a job that creates wealth in a community that pays rents and mortgages, and establish a relationship with a local policymaker, and just ask them what they're working on and see if this is something that they may be interested in learning more about and going from there. And then if you have any luck, then yeah, you can email me and I can give you some tips and pointers as to what to do next.
So it really is about, it's a case of people who listening and thinking, okay, I can, you know, I already have a community, or I can build a community. We can figure out what we need. We can see what's missing. And then doing some research. I will put a link to your book below the podcast, of course. But I mean, but doing that research and making those connections in that broader sense. I mean, strength in unity is the oldest trick in the book, right? So I guess that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that we haven't even begun to realize the opportunities and the value of our sector. You know, like I know that it is continually growing at between 8% and 10% a year now, or the global recorded sector. And, you know, I keep reading, you know, my friend Will Page's amazing analysis of the numbers keep going up. But I think that we'd barely scratch the surface. I think the music industry could be worth 3 or 4 times more than it is. And one of the reasons why is because we haven't sowed the seeds of the garden very well. So the plants are growing in weird places. I'm making hand gestures to you while, even though this isn't being
The benefits of listeners, he's miming planting
things. Especially in emerging markets, right? The UK, we've got a lot of work to do, but especially in emerging markets. And so many people are interested about music right now and excited about music as a sector, because COVID was essentially the perfect case study about why music matters. Because if music didn't matter, then we wouldn't have all used it as a crux when we were all locked in our homes. So it's a very, very exciting time, genuinely, where governments around the world of all sizes, local, national, intergovernmental, are really looking to music and thinking, all right, how can I invest in this? I had a conversation yesterday with Vietnamese government who want to create their own version of Eurovision, just for example.
Wow.
Right?
I'd watch that.
Yeah, the Ed Vision or whatever. But it's like to me, it's an immense opportunity because we're doing the work already. So wouldn't it be great if there be, you know, more investment from outside sources into our sector to further develop and incubate talent and support it in a way that, you know, we feel is equitable, and how we define as equitable. And that's something that also I believe we have a role to play in ensuring that, you know, decisions that are made in cities and communities that impact the people who live in them are done for the benefit of all community members.
It's that thing of thinking globally and acting locally, I guess. And you said there about the potential for growth. I remember one of the things, I've forgotten who it was, someone on this podcast told me a year or two ago that the recorded music industry total revenue per year is less than that of Starbucks. And that's kind of a sobering statistic, isn't it? Because you think, well, but then it also says there's room for more here if the structure is built to allow that to happen. And that's what
I think we're all focused on our day to day, and I get that. This is it's an industry that is, you know, focused on putting a lot of material out in short periods of time, right? So there's a mindset that things have to happen quickly. And my work is kind of the opposite of that. And I get that.
Right.
Things don't happen quickly when you're fighting with the UN about a policy, right? But this is, you know, I think if we just kind of raise our head above the parapet for a second, right, and think about how important music is, what if music didn't exist? Just think about that, right? Think about how fundamental music is. Throw in all the cliches, universal language and all that, but how fundamental music is to the human condition. And we haven't made it worth more than Starbucks. The world can live without Starbucks. There would still be coffee. The world cannot live without the music industry, right? Yeah. Because there would be no dissemination of music. So I think that we just have to think a little bit differently about our value and then communicate it differently to different audiences in different ways.
Good way to finish this conversation. And I will put links to the book and more information on you, Shane, and the projects you're working on, I believe the podcast. And so if anyone's interested, they can click through and maybe even initiate something in their own city. Now, talking of value of music, before we finalize this, to get a bit of context on you as a person, Shane, what is your favorite piece of music? If you could only take one thing with you, one song. Let's talk about limiting things, as you've been spending 30 minutes talking about opening it up. If you could limit it just to one song or one album, I'll accept. What would it be?
One song or one album? I don't think I can do that. It's a good question. I think if it was, you know, one song or one album right now, this is always difficult. Probably have to be Remain in Light, Talking Heads.
Ooh, you're the first person to suggest that. And that is a great
That's probably one of my favorite albums. And also, I just want to state, I'm doing a classic music industry thing and going on tour with the book. And I will have dates throughout the UK, including London, Liverpool, Leeds, Glasgow, Cardiff, and a few other places.
Hey, a book tour. That's living the dream, isn't it? Okay, I will put a link to that in the notes as well next to the podcast. You can go and meet Shane in person and talk about Remain in Light as well as everything else. All right, Shane Shapiro, thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, so huge thanks to Shane. You'll find links below the podcast to his website, where you'll find a link to being able to purchase the book if you are interested in what he spoke about. And if you found that useful, please share this podcast on with someone else who you think will also get something out of it. If you want to get in touch, I'd be extremely happy to hear from you. You can email me. That's joe@musically.com. That's joe@musically.com. Don't forget, Music Ally has a free weekly email called The Knowledge, which rounds up bits and pieces, a bouillabaisse of all the stuff that Music Ally produces. You'll find a link to that below the podcast. Sign up and impress your boss. That's it. Thanks for joining us as ever. I've been Joe Sparrow. You've been you. And until next time, farewell.